It's time for the Drive's Top 4 at 4.
Hour number 2 of the Drive underway. It's Fan Run Radio and the Top 4 at 4 brought to you this afternoon by National RX. Here once again is Marcus Young.
Thank you, Russell. Number 1, USC and UCLA are looking to leave the Pac-12 for the Big Ten in 2024, though a deal has not been finalized just yet. It is a big move that it's kind of confusing for me. Geography and conferences don't seem to care about each other anymore.
Well, how does this – the one thing that also I'm curious about, just because they've been such a thorn in the side of any kind of progress on anything involving the bowl schedules and the playoffs, is the Rose Bowl.
So you could have USC playing – against Washington in the Rose Bowl in the future.
Super weird. I didn't even think about that.
The whole Rose Bowl thing is so dumb. The two dumbest traditions that need to just go away in college football are Notre Dame being an independent. They need to join a conference. And, you know, Phil wants them in the SEC. Geographically, traditionally, they belong in the Big Ten.
Yes.
And then a close second is – the Big Ten fascination with the Rose Bowl. I don't even think the Pac-12 people, they're into it. They're not into it like the Big 12. I mean, in the 90s, in the pre-playoff days, the Michigan and Ohio State fans, if they had a chance between playing for a national championship in the Orange Bowl and just playing in the Rose Bowl, they would have rather played in the Rose Bowl.
Yeah, because they like going to California for New Year's. It's gorgeous out there, man.
And as the conferences keep changing, I will start picketing for every conference to change their name. They don't make any sense anymore. Big Ten, you know, Big 12.
Can it be one of those things?
SEC. Like,
you know how Kentucky Fried Chicken is no longer – it's just KFC.
Yeah.
Can we just become the SEC and stop referring to it as the Southeastern Conference? It's just the SEC,
and
it's just like three random letters, and like that's the brand.
I think that we ought to try and make that happen.
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think we have to do it. I think that's smarter people
sure
than us.
Yeah.
Probably figure that out.
We think of a lot of stuff before everybody else for us. Don't sell us short, buddy.
Number two.
Don't sell us long, okay? I think we're sold just right.
You don't think we're underrated?
AM radio in East Tennessee, where we belong.
We're just rated.
Yes.
We're not under
properly
or
rated.
Yeah. Number two. Big news coming out of the NBA as the free agency is getting ready to begin. Kevin Durant has decided to request a trade exactly 3 years later to the date that he signed with Brooklyn.
Where does he want to go now, is he saying?
So, according to Woj, his two of the teams that he wants to go to is Phoenix and Miami. But the Nets are planning to move Durant where they can get the best possible deal, including players and draft picks.
He's a championship chaser.
He's wanting to go with Jimmy Butler.
Wants to go to a front runner. I thought we could construct a super team in Brooklyn. Didn't work out. Oh, well, I'm just going to pack up my suitcase and leave.
Would KD push them over the top, you think, down there with Miami?
Of course, yes. Or Phoenix. Either one.
Maybe great regular season team like the Suns. The Suns were fantastic during the regular season, but as soon as they hit the postseason, they hit a wall. KD, at this point, seems to be hitting a wall unless he's with Golden State. Like, how does KD and Kyrie Irving not win a single game in a series in the tournament?
What about, now hear me out, what about the Celtics?
Who would you give up? Jaylen Brown and a bunch of draft picks? Or you're going to have to give up more than just Jaylen Brown.
I wouldn't do that if I were the Celtics.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're not giving up Tatum. Tatum's your guy. So you either have to give up Jaylen Brown.
The Nets showed us that just getting him is no guarantee of a championship. Plus, you get a little older, had some injury issues, like... I'd keep my young nucleus and try and add some pieces. I mean,
he's getting some gray in the beard. He definitely. That is weird when those guys, when guys get old.
What was the Lofton hit that shot over him in 06, 07? I mean, that's at least 15 years ago.
Yes, he's what, 33, 34 right now?
I think so, yeah.
He's getting up there. So is Steph.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying. I think of Steph and KD and all those guys as being really young to me.
Did you see the thing that was going viral yesterday of the NBA stars as women?
No.
You know, they like take people's faces and make them women. Well, that's the thing that was
creepy,
so unsettling about it is, no, they weren't ugly.
Really?
I say that as like a proud, red-blooded, heterosexual American male. But I'll show you the pictures. That's what people were saying. It's like, I feel really bad looking at this.
Who was the one that really jumped out at you?
Some of them I couldn't recognize, but like Steph was very recognizable. And I'll see if I can pull that up for you. It's unsettling.
I've seen videos of people doing that with their friends.
Yeah.
And it's super uncomfortable when you decide to do that.
Yes.
Number three, U.S. Ryder Cup captain Zach Johnson cast doubt on live or live golfers' hopes for the 2023 event. Obviously, we have a total of about 17 players who've been suspended by the PGA Tour because of LIV's tournaments. And Zach Johnson has warned American golfers that they may not be playing in Italy, saying, So I know it's this. In order to play on the Ryder Cup team, whether you're a top six or a pick, you must garner Ryder Cup points through the PGA of America. In order to garner Ryder Cup points through the PGA of America, you have to be a member of the PGA of America. The way that we're members of the PGA of America is through the PGA Tour. I'll let you connect the dots from there.
This,
I mean,
LIV Tour is...
it's divisive. Splitting people down the middle more than politics.
Tearing our country apart.
The guys that are sticking with PGA, and it's some big names. I mean, John Rahm, Tiger, Zach Johns. Those guys are, they're towing the company line.
Yeah. Huh?
They're not even, there was nothing ugly about that statement.
He's just being forward. And he even mentioned later in the article that he's friends with a lot of these guys still. So,
yeah, I mean, there's,
it happens.
It's just the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
And number four, I hate calling him a star, but Logan Paul, social media star, signed with the WWE.
It's a perfect place for him.
Apparently, he recently did a WrestleMania, teamed up with The Miz, defeating Rey and Dominique Mysterio in a tag match. And after the match, Miz turned on him.
Oh, no.
So
the old wrestling double cross. I love that, man. When two guys are friends and they're hanging out, then all of a sudden the one guy just clocks the other guy for like no reason. He's like, we're going to be enemies now.
Yeah.
This is a thing.
Although the deal has not been revealed, it's unlikely he will be a week-to-week on-screen talent, but more likely a part-time performer who appears at major events and on weekly television in support of those events.
Was a Hulk Hogan heel turn, the Hollywood Hulk Hogan, the greatest?
It was a good one.
Him and
How did that all go down? He was in the ring and like,
dude, I've watched a bunch of videos on it. They had to really. It took, I guess it would have been Eric Bischoff, a long time, to convince him
that he could turn heel, effectively.
Was that?
Yeah, because they had planned on it. I can't remember. I'll send you the video, but how it all went down. But yeah.
Was that the whole switch with Nash and Razor Ramon? Is that what? Because I don't know.
No, it wasn't
WD.
Razor Ramon. It was.
Scott Hall.
Yeah, it was just Scott Hall and Kevin.
I know he was going, but hey,
he joined them. Hey, yo.
Hey, yo.
During the Monday Night Wars.
All right. Good stuff, Marcus.
Probably a direct result of they've got some culpability. I feel like late 90s professional wrestling had way too big of an influence on American society.
I see that, yeah. Well, we've lost heroes. We don't have heroes in America anymore. We don't have good guys. Like, that's what drew me to wrestling as a young child in the 1980s, is Hulk Hogan would be out there, and you'd have the Iron Sheik or some other bad, and Hulk Hogan would come out with the damn American flag and his yellow Superman costume and kick some bleep and bleep.
Yeah.
You know?
Rise of the anti-hero.
Like, yeah, he's a great guy. And then, I mean, Stone Cold, God bless him. We all love Stone Cold and The Rock, but were bad guy, good guys.
But when you think about it.
By the way, The Rock was, before he turned face, like before he became, you know.
Oh, he was a fantastic heel.
Maybe the best heel ever of all time.
Yeah.
It was so hateable.
Oh, yeah.
He just knew how to press every damn button.
Just awful, but when you stop and take a step back and look at it and think about it, that whole Stone Cold Steve Austin anti-hero
attitude
deal.
Attitude era.
The Attitude era of WWE had very far-reaching effects, I think, on entertainment. Because in the 2000s, that's when you saw like Walter White and all
Tony
these
anti-heroes.
Yeah, Tony Soprano. And it, almost every hit show that everybody loves and
talks about.
Go
ahead and say
about.
It, Bear. Wrestling is responsible for all the ills of modern society. I like
I
the
think
theory.
It's a big contributor to,
there's
to
a good
the decline
think piece
of our
of
Western
for,
civilization.
The HuffPost in there somewhere that you can write up.
About the HuffPost?
See, I still
those
love,
people don't like me over there.
I saw that quote from
what do you
Scott
mean, those
Hall.
People? Sorry, go ahead.
No, no, you're good. So, do we want to go into what he just said?
Sure.
What do you mean, those people?
Do what?
Isn't that what you just said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
what do
thought...
you mean, those people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
People on the further extremes usually don't like me. Either side of the discussion.
When I think of you, Bear, I just think right down the middle, just like a guy who's never going to make odds with anyone, is just a straight shooter, moderate. That's the word I think of when I
now,
think of
I'm not
of
saying
you.
Moderate, but I'm pro-common, you know. I'll give you an honest
yeah,
answer.
Common sense. That's what I think of. When I think of you screaming obscenities into a telephone after another Florida touchdown, I think this guy is moderate. A lot of common sense coming through my telephone right now.
Oh, I'm passionate.
Yeah. Now, there's the quote from Scott Hall during his Hall of Fame speech that I just love, which is, the hard work pays off, dreams come true, bad times don't last, but bad guys do.
Nice. That is the Top 4 at 4 brought to you by National RX. Going to be out there tomorrow to wrap up the work week. Come on out and see me. I have Smokies tickets for you. If you want to take a 9-inning vacation at Smokies Park, they had a no-hitter out there earlier this week. You never know what you're going to see out there. Good baseball to be seen. Come check me out. Speaking of ballparks, coming up here in just a few moments, a conversation with Paul Goldberger. He wrote the book on the great American ballpark. Not talking about the one in Cincinnati, just the history of baseball stadiums. That is interesting, especially with all the talk we have about Lindsey Nelson Stadium, the new downtown Smokies Park that they're getting set to build. We're going to talk to him coming up here in just a few minutes about baseball stadiums. It's going to be an interesting conversation. Stay tuned for that. In the meantime, we visit with TJ, the Kentucky fan. Good afternoon, TJ. You're on the drive.
Hey, what's up, guys? How y'all doing?
Doing well, Tej. What's going on?
Not a lot. Hey, you know, it's kind of crazy because I think this is getting more attention because it's football. Kentucky and South Carolina are in the Sun Belt Conference in men's soccer. Kentucky used to be in the Conference USA in men's soccer. There's other sports as well that other teams are, like, look at Notre Dame. They're in the ACC in basketball. They're in the Big Ten and volleyball or whatever it is. I think it's getting more attention, though, because, let's face it, college football is what makes college sports go round. So I think that's why everybody's saying, you know, oh my goodness, everybody's going here, going there, what? But they don't even realize that their own school isn't even in the SEC in this sport or that sport.
Yeah, it's strange. Isn't the Tennessee, like, Lady Vol rowing team, aren't they in the American Athletic Conference or something? Yeah, it's a good point, TJ. Just all these sports not necessarily going to the Big Ten when you talk about USC, UCLA, or these other schools.
And I think, you know, I agree. I think it was I forgot who said it, but I think they need to just take a map of the United States, get the Power Five schools, draw a line from east to west, draw a line from north to south, right in the middle of the United States, have four divisions, four quadrants, whatever you want to call them, have, you know, the northwest, the southwest, the southeast, the northeast, yeah. And boom, call it good. The top eight from those go to the college football playoff. The rest of y'all get these little bowl games that mean absolutely nothing and just call it square from there.
Well, it might not happen as cleanly as you just put it, but I think that's kind of the general direction this is headed in of, you know, four power conferences and expanded college football playoff, and I think you're going to get your wish eventually, TJ.
Hey, and I got to ask, me and my buddy were talking the other day. what's more rewarding to you in sports? Is it getting the in-state guy who's number one state prospect, or is it going to your rival state and taking a top five prospect from there? What's the biggest signing to you guys?
Say that again. Now, going to a rival state and stealing a guy out of there, or what's the other one?
Or your in-state number one prospect.
I think you got to get the in-state number one because that hurts more. When you lose a guy in-state, that just always irks me.
Yeah, I don't know. It's pretty nice, though, to go up there to Ohio or Michigan and get a football recruit from Michigan or Michigan State or Ohio State. I know you'd feel the same if you went down to Florida and stole a recruit from Florida or Alabama down there in Alabama, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you got to – just player. I would rather have the five-star from Kentucky than the three-star from Tennessee any day of the week. You just give me good players wherever they come from. That's how you know this in basketball. You'd rather have the five-star one-and-done from California than the three-star guy who averages 4 points a game over the course of a four-year career from Kentucky, TJ.
You know what's crazy? I'll get off here after this. You might be shocked, but there is an outcry in Lexington and Kentucky for the past 5 or 6 years because John Calipari won't sign the in-state kids. I'm sorry, but I would rather – I'm with you. I'd rather take the five-star from Oregon or California than the three- or four-star from Lexington.
Got to have players.
Y'all have a cool one, man.
Thank you, TJ.
I was going to ask him before he hopped off. I want to know his honest opinion if he thought Mark Stoops is number three. TJ, if you're listening,
he doesn't
still
really believe that.
Next time you call on, tell me, because I want to know if you think Mark Stoops is the third best, according to Mark Hayes of Saturday Down South.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we continue, Paul Goldberger is going to join us here on the show. We're going to talk to him about baseball stadiums and the two new ones that are coming here to Knoxville in the very near future, as well as what's going on major league-wise and you know what makes a good baseball stadium. What should we be shooting for here in Knoxville with the two new ones that are coming soon? Stay with us. That's coming up next. The Drive. More Fan Run Radio after this. Drive continues. Fan Run Radio. Russell Smith cruising along with you here, a Thursday afternoon edition of the show. And pleased to be joined right now by Paul Goldberger. He has written a book, Ballpark Baseball in the American City. Paul, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks, Russell. Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. And, you know, I say you've written the book. It's actually 2 years old. I stumbled across it in the local library. It was just blown away. It was kind of a picture book, Paul. I was a sports radio guy, you know, and I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting there reading the whole thing. It was just fantastic. Take me through it a little bit. How did you get the idea to write about that?
Well, thanks. First, it's great. It's great to know the book is still interesting people a couple years after its publication. Although I certainly wrote it hoping it would have a long life.
Sure.
I love baseball. I'm an architecture critic by profession, and I'd always loved that funny little place where baseball and architecture intersect, which is, you know, ballparks and stadiums. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that there was a big story that nobody had ever told. You know, there are a lot of nice coffee table books of just pictures of ballparks. There are some nice guidebooks if you are one of those crazy people who wants to go around the country and see all of them. But nobody had ever tracked how baseball parks really do tell you the whole story of the American city. You know, baseball emerged out of cities, even though we like to fantasize that it's a rural game. It really grew mostly in cities in the 19th century. And the original ballparks were part of tight, dense little urban neighborhoods. We still can see that if you look at Fenway in Boston, for example, with the funny shape of the green monster. It's all because of the street pattern that surrounds the ballpark. And then in the mid-20th century, just as so many people were moving to the suburbs, baseball, too, became a suburban thing with these big concrete stadiums with, you know, acres of parking around them. And then beginning with Camden Yards for the Baltimore Orioles in 1992, they started coming back into the center of the city again, just as a lot of other people were rediscovering living in the city and trying to reintegrate baseball into the city. So baseball is really a mirror of how our whole culture has looked at cities. And I love when sports tells a story that's not just about itself, but about something else as well.
Paul Goldberger joining us this afternoon. And it's interesting, we're actually in the process of building not one, but two ballparks here in Knoxville for the local minor league team. And the college team is basically redoing its entire park here. I want to get your thoughts on that. But first, sure. Paul, you mentioned Camden Yards. And I think for most of us, most people listening to this right now, that was the first time that I had even thought about a baseball stadium as something that was more than just a place where a team played, something as part of the fabric of a city and a community. And I thought that was the most interesting part of your book, was that whole chapter, just telling the story of how it came to be.
Well, it's a great story because at that time, the Orioles were owned by a man named Eli Jacobs, who had grown up in Boston and loved baseball and grew up with Fenway Park. And he also happened to have a particular interest in architecture. And the first meeting with the architects, who had been hired by the prior owner, but then Jacobs took over, they came and presented a plan, which was basically one of these big concrete donuts that was kind of like the stadiums that were being built in the 60s and 70s. But this was the late 80s. And he said, but I don't want that. I want something that feels different. And they sort of hemmed and hawed. And he said, no, this is not acceptable. It's got to be something else. And we're going to have to start over. And either you do it or if we find another architect. And it's a little more complicated, of course, than that, because he also had a very good CEO of the team who had grown up in Pittsburgh and remembered Forbes Field as for his childhood and was also pushing very hard in this direction. And ultimately, the architects, which was HOK Sport, which now is a firm called Populous out of Kansas City, they came back with the design that they built. And it's a real case of a client kind of pushing an architect in the right direction. It's also just about the only case I know of anywhere where one single building changed the direction of a whole building type. You know, people try to do new kinds of schools or new kinds of hospitals or new kinds of factories and stuff, but you never see a case where one of them is done one way and then suddenly everything follows in that direction. But that's what happened with baseball. After Camden Yards, nobody would ever build another big concrete donut again. They started building these really nice urban ballparks, which we now have in quite a number of cities. Cleveland followed close after, Minneapolis, Denver, San Francisco, and so forth and so on. There's really a lot of them now. And all of them are better than the ones that preceded them, I think. Pittsburgh, which I think for me is the very best of all, PNC Park in Pittsburgh.
Absolutely. All the ballparks now, they're brick and green seats, just like Camden Yards. And that's what they're trying to do here in Knoxville at the new minor league stadium.
That's great. That's wonderful. That's what it should be. Because, one of the other key things about baseball is they're not all supposed to be the same. You're supposed to feel some sense of the city you're in. It's very different. Say football, basketball, hockey, soccer. There, the sport is played on the defined space of the goal, or rather the defined space of a grid with a goal at each end, and it's not supposed to vary. It has to be exactly the same. Baseball, only the diamond is determined. Everything else is kind of loose and should be a little bit different from place to place. And the reason PNC is so great is because you're looking at the skyline of Pittsburgh and the bridges and the river when you're sitting at your seat, and it's wonderful. And that's what is so special about baseball, I think, that you feel you're in a place that's different from other places. And the game is even played a little bit differently. The dimensions and the where the outfield walls are and so forth shift a little bit from place to place. That's as it should be.
I think you're getting close to the architect's version of the George Carlin baseball versus football routine
it's
right now.
True. Well, but he's right. Yeah. He's right. He was right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad that Knoxville is trying to push things in that direction. I think it's a good thing. And a lot of the minor league ballparks have been really, really good. I don't deal with them much in my book only because there's so many, and it would have made it. I didn't want the book to be like a sort of a catalog. I wanted it to really tell a story and to be engaging as a story. So I couldn't deal with all the minor league ballparks, but a lot of them are really, really good. And one of them in Buffalo actually set the tone for Camden Yards, preceded Camden Yards by a little bit, and that was sort of the one that showed that you can do it in our day and age, and led ultimately to Camden Yards, which was the really influential one. But since minor league parks are smaller, it's also easier to make them feel good because, you know, a lot of the problem with the bigger ballparks is they just are too gargantuan, which feels fine for football. It doesn't feel right for baseball. You want some intimacy and connection with baseball, I think.
But you get into this question, too, about whether or not a stadium can rejuvenate a blighted area of town. That's kind of the situation we're dealing with here for the minor league part, Paul, is you've got you know, this fun, lively area of downtown, and then there's this place, there's nothing, which connects to a not-so-nice part of town. Is that your experience when you look at these things? Can it sort of rejuvenate an area of town that might not have been so nice to begin with?
Well, I'll tell you, the answer is yes, up to a point, but it's not fair to put the whole thing on the ballpark. It can't do it all by itself, and it's worked best in cities where it's had some connection to something else as well. In other words, you know, if you put it in a part of town that's a total wilderness, it's just a ballpark isn't quite strong enough. It's like sort of an engine that doesn't have quite enough horsepower. It just can't quite pull itself all the way there. If it's on the edge and sort of connects to some other things and other activities, remember, a ballpark, even though it's used a fair amount, it's hardly a 52-week-a-year operation either, and nor is it every single day. So You do need some other stuff going on to help. A ballpark can be a great catalyst, and it can certainly work well with other things. I mean, in Washington, D.C., for example, you know, the new Nationals Park has been very successful in the old Navy Yard neighborhood, but that was a part of the city that was beginning to regenerate anyway, and then the ballpark gave it a further push forward. There's now a lot of apartments nearby, some restaurants and stores, and they all reinforce each other. And I think that's what ultimately has to happen. A ballpark can be one of the best elements of urban regeneration, but if you ask it to do the entire job all by itself with no help from any other function, you know, any apartments or offices or workplaces or restaurants or bars, it can't quite do that all by itself.
So I got to ask you about Atlanta. A lot of Braves fans in the area, and you wrote somewhat ambivalently about Truist Park.
Right.
Nice looking piece of classical ballpark construction, but there's a lack of, I guess, authenticity there that bothers you.
Yes.
Do you think is that a one-off, or do you think that we're going to see more Truist Parks in the future?
Well, I hope we don't. The irony of Truist Park is that the Braves left downtown Atlanta, and they tried to create their own kind of little urban environment around the park with a completely kind of invented city. So it's a kind of almost like a theme park that has a ballpark at its heart, but also does have a couple of office buildings. I think there is a hotel, a couple of condos, a lot of restaurants. It's kind of fun to walk around there, but it's a little bit like walking around a big shopping mall. It's a kind of artificial place. Ironically, they did that trying to get a kind of urban environment because they thought that the part of downtown Atlanta that they were in was kind of bleak. And it was, actually. They were not in the best location in Atlanta. If the city and the team had worked together, they could have maybe embarked on a larger renewal effort for that part of downtown Atlanta, and it would have been better, I think, ultimately, than if they'd gone to where they went. What we have been seeing are a lot of teams very interested not only in what happens inside the gates of the ballpark, but trying to control as much of what happens outside as possible. So we've seen situations, say, in older cities where, like at Wrigley Field in Chicago, which is, you know, one of the greatest ballparks ever built, the current ownership of the Cubs has now acquired a lot of the land outside, around the stadium, is renewing a lot of it. It's less messy than it used to be, but on the other hand, you know, it's better than if they'd gone out to the suburbs like Atlanta did. And or in St. Louis, where a new ballpark was built a few years ago, next to the old one, also downtown, and the Cardinals took the site of the original ballpark, of the earlier ballpark, wasn't the original, but the previous one, and they developed it as, I think, what they call Ballpark Village, which is a whole lot of bars, restaurants, a Cardinals museum, and even a condo building, so you can live there if you want. But the point is, it all connects to the urban activity of the rest of St. Louis and renews it. And they were acknowledging there what I said a few minutes ago, which is the ballpark can't do it all by itself. But what it can be is the key element in a bigger renewal effort. And so I hope in Knoxville they will not try to make the ballpark do all the heavy lifting, but, you know, develop a few other things around it. And then you really do have a lot of synergy. It's why San Francisco's worked so incredibly well. Or Coors Field in Denver, which was built at the edge of a section of Denver, an old section of Denver that had been renewing slowly anyway, with a lot of interesting historic buildings and stuff had begun to happen. And the ballpark was a huge step forward for it. But it also relates to all the other stuff, and they kind of reinforce each other. And now you've got an incredibly vibrant, healthy part of Denver there now, with the ballpark added at its heart. It's the best. It's great.
Talking with Paul Goldberger this afternoon. Paul, a couple more things. We'll let you run
here. Sure.
I was in Texas 2 weeks ago, and I had a chance to go to the Rangers' new ballpark, Globe Life Field, and Minute Maid Park in Houston. Two indoor parks with retractable roofs, somewhat, you know, similar in their reasons for existing. It's Texas and it's hot, but so different in feel and the context in which they are located inside their cities. Why does Minute Maid feel so much more authentic than Globe Life?
Okay, well, Russell, you're totally right. Minute Maid is more authentic than Globe Life. It's in downtown Houston. It relates to other things in downtown Houston. It's not in the middle of nowhere. Remember, they had an experience with a ballpark in the middle of nowhere. They had the Astrodome, which was the original dome stadium and was an amazing, mind-blowing thing. But it was also terrible for baseball. It was just, you know, it was all about cutting off from the outside, and baseball really is an outdoor game. And it's a city game. And Minute Maid now is connected to everything else in Houston. It even has that old remnant of a train station as a part of it. And one of the ways you can go into it is through the preserved old station entrance. And it's a kind of nice place. And I also much prefer ballparks with retractable roofs to ones that have permanent roofs, because whenever the weather permits it, you really want it to be open. I can understand how, you know, in a city like Houston, nobody wants to sit at an afternoon game in July under that sun. But, you know, sometimes there's a lot of night games, and sometimes it's cool and breezy and pleasant at night. And so, you know, it's great to be able to have it open when possible. And whereas Globe Life is like the new Atlanta Truist Park, it's a kind of make-believe place. It's not connected to a city. It's too bad that the Rangers didn't build either in Dallas or in Fort Worth, where it could have connected to and helped regenerate those downtowns. You know, instead, it's out kind of in the middle of nowhere in a kind of sports theme park that, you know, it just makes me kind of sad. I mean, the prior Globe Life, which was only 25 years old when they tore it down, was actually a pretty decent building. It was one of the post-Camden Yards buildings that tried to be more traditional, and but it was a kind of urban building in search of an urban, without an urban site. Yeah. So it never quite worked. The reason that it went was because it did not have a roof. I remember the original architect of that telling me he was convinced that they could add a roof if the team and the fans really insisted on it, but instead they decided to tear it down and start all over again with a one that was built to have a roof. So that's what they did.
I can't imagine not having a roof down there. It was 105 degrees. I'm walking in that place, Paul. I'm like, oh my God! I can't. They used to watch games outside all the time down there. It's crazy.
I know. Look, I remember being. I was at the opening of the earlier Globe Life back in 19. Sometime in the mid 90s, I think it was, in 94 maybe, and it was hot, no doubt about that. It was hot. Yeah.
Paul, last thing, thank you for being so generous with your time here today. And again, we're talking with Paul Goldberger. His book, Ballpark Baseball in the American City, fantastic if you love baseball parks. One of the names that keeps popping up in the course of your book is Populous Architecture. They're designing both the ballparks here in Knoxville for the Tennessee Smokies and the University of Tennessee. I think they've actually got a satellite office here in town. So let's end where we began, Paul. It's kind of Camden Yards, right? Is how they cornered the market.
They were a very dominant firm before Camden Yards.
Okay.
It's interesting, actually. Most of sports architecture comes out of Kansas City. It's a historical accident that they are in Kansas City, but they are. And then over the years, people have left that firm but stayed in Kansas City and opened up, you know, competing firms and so forth. So Kansas City is now the American center of all sports architecture, not just baseball. But they've done a lot of the really, really good stuff. They did have to be pulled into Camden Yards by their client. They, as I said, they originally came up with a design that was a kind of ugly concrete bunker. But when their client insisted on something else, they quickly figured it out, and then they produced a really wonderful result. And then they became, people who convert to a religion. They suddenly became the most zealous of all. And they started going around doing these great ballparks all over the place. And they now are really the preeminent designers. There are other people around, but they are really the preeminent firm. One thing that's, I think, helped them is they've always had a good sense about listening to clients and about making different ballparks different to express the feeling of that city. And so they will feel it's important, even if the folks in Knoxville don't tell them this, they will feel it's important that what they do in Knoxville not be the same as what they did in Miami, which is not the same as they did in Denver and not the same as Seattle and so forth. They want it to express in some way the feeling of that city. And that's really important. I think that's the beginning of good ballpark architecture, is trying to do that.
Great. Paul, really appreciate your time again, my friend. Thank you for jumping on with us. We could talk.
Thank you for discovering the book.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. Appreciate it.
It was outstanding. Paul Goldberger, thanks so much.
Great. Thank you, Russell. Good to talk to you.
All right, you too.
Bye. Take care. Bye.
That's Paul Goldberger. Ballpark Baseball in the American City is the name of the book. If you want to go check that out at a library or on Amazon, it's available anywhere. And fascinating conversation, and it'll be interesting to see what ends up happening here in Knoxville with both the new Smokies Ballpark downtown and, of course, Lindsey Nelson Stadium, and that architecture firm Populous, I believe, is designing both of those updates So we'll look forward to seeing what they come up with. We got to take a quick timeout. Stay with us. You're listening to The Drive. More Fan Run Radio coming up.
Back here on The Drive, Fan Run Radio. I hope you liked that segment. A couple of y'all did, judging from social media. Really excited to have the Smokies back in downtown Knoxville, man. And for those of us who grew up going to games at Bill Meyer Stadium, that was always super cool. But it was also, it was not a super nice ballpark in terms of amenities and things like that, which there is something nostalgic about that in and of itself. Just going sitting on a creaky wood chair with a bag of popcorn and a cold beer or something like that. But having a state-of-the-art stadium and in a little bit nicer spot, hopefully it will lift up the surrounding area over there and be a place where fans can walk to. You can go and catch the ball game, but also hang out in the old city in downtown Knoxville. You park somewhere in downtown Knoxville, maybe in the State Street Garage or something like that, and walk down to the ball game and make an evening out of it. Really exciting. Really exciting to have them come back. And then that's been something we've been talking about for years on this show, is the Smokies coming back to downtown Knoxville. But I'm almost more interested at this point in the Lindsey Nelson Stadium redo. And the good thing about that is, like, location is obviously not an issue. It's on campus. It's just a different vibe that you're going for in the college game. But the renderings that we saw a couple of weeks ago, I know Danny White gave an interview this week saying that's not necessarily how it's close.
The final
to,
renderings.
Yeah, it's close to what it's probably going to be, but there are some options there. That's going to be so cool, man.
Mm.
That is going to be so
like,
so
I have
cool.
no doubt that the Smokies will – I mean, that park's going to be perfect. Probably a great place to go catch a game. But I am more interested in what UT's – I'm more invested in Tennessee baseball.
Doesn't sound like we're going to get our pool in the outfield.
Why not?
I don't know. Something about revenue streams and profitability. You know, athletic director mumbo jumbo. I hear Vitello fought for us, though, behind the scenes. You can't win them all, though, is what I was told.
Appreciate it, Coach. That's why we always have his back.
865-546-8200. You want to chime in here this afternoon? 546-8200. And talk to CG about that. The Oakland ballpark. Have you seen the stadium that they're designing for the A's?
No, huh?
It's wild, man. They found a location in downtown Oakland near the bay, and it's like a rundown warehouse place, kind of like where Camden Yards and Petco Park and the Nationals Park and all these places have gone. But you got to go check out the artist renderings for it, because it's got like three tiers of seats, like a stadium, but I can't even describe this. Like, they've got a green space. Have you ever been to the High Line in New York City, where it's like an elevated green space park going through kind of the Lower West Side?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
It's almost like that on top of the stadium. They've got grass on top of it and like trees and stuff. And
okay.
Like people lounging around, like a park atmosphere on top
of the stadium.
Yeah.
That's a new thing.
And then it slopes down. It's a new thing? This is the first place I've ever seen anything like this. And it slopes down towards the outfield, kind of like Kauffman Stadium where the Kansas City Royals play. You know how that kind of – it looks like the concrete donut from behind home plate, but then it kind of slopes down towards the edges. Maybe not. I'm a nerd. But anyway, it does that and just kind of like flows down into where you can almost just walk straight into the stadium from the outfield into the park. I'll show you some pictures here during the break. But that's far out. Because
I mean, as far as the stadium goes, yeah, but that I have seen that in magazines. It's a growing trend where – people are building structures.
With like grass and stuff on it. Japan has like apartment high rises with,
you know, grass and green stuff.
Green stuff.
Yeah. Flowers and trees and all that
plant
stuff.
Yeah. Foliage.
Stuff that, you know,
green stuff.
Cleans some of the smog out of the air while it's up there.
That wouldn't be a bad thing. Like, you know, if you had like a deck or like a patio or something like that, have a little bit of grass sitting there just to, you know, still get the shade while having your feet in the grass.
Yeah, and I'm fairly certain one of the Market Square places has, you know, there's all those rooftop bars in there now. And I'm pretty sure a couple of them are.
And you young people, the millennial generation has all the cool bars and stuff. Now that like Bear and I are too old to go hang out at bars.
I mean, when we were in college, it was what, the Mercury?
Yeah, there was nothing to. Nobody went to Market Square. There was literally nothing there. Nobody went to Gay Street.
Subway was open back then. And then I think, it was Mercury because.
I don't think I ever went down there until they started having concerts and stuff down. And now there's so many people down there that
it's not big enough to do those shows.
Yeah, they can't even have shows down there.
Those things were a nightmare.
I mean, I guess that's a good thing.
The irony is most of the bars I attend are more this side of town. Like, my side of town, so I should say.
You look like more of a barcade guy. Like, so if they've got one of those old school Pac-Man things, like that's kind of more Marcus's speed.
I've been to
kind of feel like you're trying to stereotype our guy here.
I guess this is
you a nerd.
I'm
Marcus.
A nerd. Hey, I mean, from one nerd to another, I know my kind when I see him. I'm sitting next to one right now.
I know which bar you're talking about. If it's what I think you're talking about,
all the arcade games. What is that?
There's a place called Token, and they literally have arcade games, and it's like a bar. Yeah. No, I mean the last one I went to was Bull Feathers. Yeah.
Didn't they have a guy get like knifed there in the parking lot a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I mean, they have.
That's not necessarily the sign of a bad bar either. Yeah. I mean, you want a little bit of element of danger in the unknown when you go out for a good night of drinking and wings.
Not if you work at the bar, you don't. Things can get scary quick.
I don't mean to be casting aspersions. I'm sure it's a lovely place of business.
They do karaoke there.
You sing karaoke again?
I did it.
I could see that.
I did it once. It was nerve-wracking beyond belief.
What was your song?
Ophelia by the Band.
Oh, yeah. Really?
I'm a fan of the band, yeah.
He's a fan of the band. Wow.
Last Waltz is one of my favorite music documentaries ever done.
What's your favorite band song?
It's either that or
Tonight They Drove Old Dixie.
That's one of them, too. Yeah. I like Stage Fright's a good one, too.
Well, you didn't say The Weight, so that tells me that you're more than just a passing fan. That's good.
So that one, is it? Danko sings it. It Makes No Difference. Is that on The Last Waltz?
Yeah.
That's my favorite band song. You know, a lot of people have a problem with that movie. Well, a lot of the rest of the band did.
Well,
They weren't named Robbie Robertson.
Right. No, I understand that. I mean, it's a great documentary, but yeah, I definitely. I'm sure how frustrating it was for them for him to be like, yep, this is the end. And they're like, wait, what? We want to keep going.
What you need to do is you need to read, I think the book's called Bill Graham Presents or My Life or something. The Bill Graham bio. But because he was running, I think that was at the Fillmore West, right?
I think so.
Or it may have been one of the bars. I'm not really sure. That was a Bill Graham production.
Boy, we are right now.
It was directed by Scorsese.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool, too.
But they served everybody in that ballroom. It was on Thanksgiving night. They played that show. Yeah, it's a legendary show.
King Harvest is a good one, too, by the way.
Coming up in hour number three. If you guys need to continue your conversation out in the atrium, then annex, and please.
Go ahead, Russ.
Go ahead, yes. Meanwhile, we're going to pivot back to sports here. There's a huge story developing in the world of college football. For those of you just joining us, the Pac-12 is on the brink of collapse this afternoon following the news that USC and UCLA are packing their bags for the perceived greener pastures of the Big Ten. Marcus will reset that topic for you when we continue. Still no formal notification from the two schools, but as we talked about earlier, we have some experience dealing with this here in the SEC twice now in the last 12 years, Missouri, Texas A&M, and now Oklahoma, Texas entering the league. Usually when it gets to this point, usually when this we've seen this movie before, right? When two schools, it's announced that they're thinking about leaving one conference for another, the bags are almost always packed. I mean, I guess the one notable exception was when Texas and Oklahoma, and I believe Oklahoma State, maybe it might have been four schools from the Big 12 were rumored to be heading towards the Pac-12. That obviously never came to fruition, but this, just sitting here and reading through some things over the past 3 or 4 hours since the news broke, seems like a done deal. Seems like a done deal. So we will reset that topic for those of you just joining us and go through some of the nitty-gritty details when we continue. Stay with us. Hour number three of The Drive coming up here on Fan Run Radio. We're on 105.7 FM, 1340 AM this afternoon, streaming live at fanrunradio.com and your free Fan Run app, a variety of ways for you to experience the program. And we're back with hour number three of the show coming up next. Stay with us.